to an ex-wife. In bed, in a house, in some city, a woman, one I haven't seen in 10 years, mutters the long list of my shortcomings in her sleep, the sweaty old quarrels. She leaves me a little while before the gray cumulus lifts, for coffee and red light floods the apartment. She curses my name and hers at high noon on the foot-hurting, merciless streets, for the length of time it takes her not to love the husband who shambled in and up to the second-hand counter after me, my dear, my lovely bargain. The machines. This is the same factory I was at in Vancouver. It's a Vancouver bedding, by the way. He sweated vomit over those damn things. Blood and oil on his hands gave him a stupid dignity, like a bear smeared with garbage. The days fled into smoky weeks, and he learned to operate one machine after another. Learned them all. How to gauge the spock of a needle plunging hard through cloth beside his hand. Adjusting the varied rhythms of flesh with the balanced, shifting stance of a boxer anticipating his steel opponent, and walking backward all day long, pursued 6 feet lengthways and 4 feet 6 inches sideways by a spastic hunchback detective on rails, urging him to confess, with metal jaws going graph, graph every 2 seconds, and managed to retain all 10 clever fingers. Perhaps a soul. At the end, all the submissive hymning roar of machines praised him for what he was, took him for master and lord mechanic of their metal destiny, until one afternoon he shoved a pipe wrench into closing jaws and heard them groan out steel blood and shriek once for their anthropomorphic god. Fired, he went into the street laughing. Picked up a woman near Maine and Hastings, paid her $5 and went to bed and sobbed himself to sleep. That business of the 6 feet lengthways and 4 feet 6 inches sideways is the exact length of a full-size mattress. Mountain lions in Stanley Park, Vancouver, B.C. Canadian as the Winnipeg Gold Eye or the Calgary Eye Opener. And regional in this province is strontium 90, and international as a boundary. They lived here before night's fuses were blown. Remember the child? He thought darkness had a nucleus, something plotting outside of ranges. Read it again. Mountain lions in Stanley Park, Vancouver, B.C. Canadian as the Winnipeg Gold Eye. Or the Calgary Eye Opener, and regional in this province is strontium 90, and international as a boundary. They lived here before night's fuses were blown. Remember the child? He thought darkness had a nucleus, something plotting outside his range of vision, something that moved and shambled, laughed without logic, and drooled. It's rather a comfort now to see the caged cougars, fierce eyes focused, serious, non-idiotic, and to be involved in the cougars' simple problems. The snap of a bone in the head, exchanging light for darkness, and walking to the edge of this floodlit concrete, not stopping at all, on the edge of the great trees. Sun-colored cougar, you have forgotten the past in this managed place where the sky is snugged down with green tent pegs. Buildings litter the landscape like rubble, and a river of animals hoarsely pouring down the morning into foglit factories. Remember quickly the nature of boundaries. And child of darkness, remember the future. Those strange beasts under the horizon will want to ask questions concerning your birthplace. Require of you reasons for departure, deny you entry to the walking forest. Say to them, the name is unpronounceable, but there will be other beasts where I am going. We will meet there. This next poem is In the Wilderness. A friend and I went out. The first half of this poem was written a year before the other, the first one-third of it, and I was in Vancouver about 63 at the time when the Duke of Boers went to Agassiz. Left their wherever they were living in Vancouver and went to Agassiz. And a friend and I drove out and met Big Fanny. She since died of cancer, by the way. In the wilderness, on the road to Agassiz in winter of 1962, grandfathers, young wives, old children, marching in the savage demolitions of hunger for their own people, to the mountain prison at Agassiz, where incendiarious husbands and incandescent nephews and sons of that pale yellow soap-like stuff which is dynamite are locked away near a town named for the gentle naturalist, Louis Agassiz. In a way unrealized, these are the children of Israel, with a pillar of fire by day and a pillar of fire by night standing over them in the mountains. In this wilderness of 1962, we are all around them. Big Fanny with sore feet slapping onto the gravel road. Pete Elisoff with rock bruises. The old men with prophet's beards and a pillar of fire by day standing over them on the Hope Princeton Highway. And stirrings of gravel sliding down in the deep blue misted morning at the trickling afterbirth of mountains. Note for historians, we have set up bylaws for snares and deadfall regulations to trap them. The roads are shadowy with swaying nooses of municipal officials. The highways are luminous with mounties and roadblocks and vote-catching grins of ambitious attorney generals, riding all night against these shivering foot soldiers, slogging at dawn through the frosty ranges. Sitting in Agassiz with Big Fanny in 1963, talking with Big Fanny at Agassiz, while the Mounties D Squad drives by in Chevys and Pontiacs, continually hovering, talking of young Podmaroff, who died in Agassiz Mountain Prison, was buried home in the Kootenays, talking of 100 men fasting and dying in Agassiz Mountain Prison, the sons of mothers and daughters of husbands, and Big Fanny, I was 15 days in water and lemon, and now apple and prune juice. 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness, while the D-Squad looked and hovered, and the pillar of fire by day stood over the Sons of Freedom at Agassiz. Talking with Big Fanny about the mystic Lebedev, comic opera Satan Lebedev, Judas enemy of Peter Verigen's people, who plots against them in the far mountains, schemes at Windle for the people's destruction, accepting another 30 pieces of silver, smiling, and the Mounties D Squad cruising and hovering. Talking to Big Fanny, making notes for an article. I think of coeval saints and ascetics and the ordinary people with such bright illusions of extraordinary freedom, those troublemakers of God. Could you find one in a nightclub, for instance, walking across the floor and changing? And how can they ever be sure they are what they seem to become? Stand up straight where the lights are glaring, bright with microphones and flashbulbs, and everyone screaming and listening, and people saving your bathwater to sell for $2 a bottle, and raffling off your dirty underwear at the next scheduled crucifixion, and the eyes of gentle people turning animal. I wonder how it feels to have your plodding pedestrian mind sprout wings and fly, handsome as an actor playing Icarus toward the cold sun truth. Talking with Big Fanny at Agassiz in 1963, sitting on an old blue mattress cover, and she with her shoes off, talking and talking of Judas Lebedev, plotting against them at Windle. Talking of exile on Piers Island in the Gulf of Georgia in 1932, and Fanny in Kingston Penn for 3 years in 1947-50, did they allow her to go barefoot? Sitting on an old blue mattress cover with Florence Storgoff in 1963, and a pillar of fire by day shining over the mountains at Agassiz, while shanties of old Kotex boxes covered with waterproof plastic are built near the dusty road, and the children flash by in the running games of children laughing. The old men with prophet's beards stand in the road with pamphlets, and I write in a steno's notebook as the tourists watch and wonder. I drink some apple juice, thinking, watching the busty young females, that my thoughts are not ascetic. A and Florence Starograph, all 250 pounds of her, talks of persecution and religious freedom on a side road near Agassiz in 1963. And the old men sing in a strange tongue, in sorrow's language, over the darkening landscape of fir trees and mountains, and tremulous whispering voices of the night animals boom in the swamp, and night birds cry over snick of rifle bolts. And down the road the prisoners are dying, the young hunger strikers are dying little by little. But I am not one of them, I'm not one of these people, nor do I wish to be. But remember their names, Varagin, Elisov, Podmorov, and Big Fanny, the sore feet hurting, the jubilant bombers and blazing incendiarists, the naysayers and spirit wrestlers of the Kootenai, the Mounties D squad cruising and hovering, and overhead where the mist surrounds them, a pillar of fire or a flash of lightning, a pillar of fire or only the prison floodlights. Varagin, Elisov, Podmorov, and Big Fanny, and we stand around in the wilderness watching, and we are the wilderness. Remember their names. Well, there are a number of poems in this book that were written in Emiliusburg. I probably should say something about Emiliusburg. I sold two plays to CBC when I was living in Montreal in 1955-56. I got about $1,000 for it, and we took the money and put it as a down payment on a lot, this lot near Emiliusburg, and bought a big pile of used lumber and built the house ourselves, quarreling bitterly over how to lay, this is my wife and I, quarreling bitterly over how to lay concrete blocks and so on all the time. However, we lived there until we'd both made up our mind that neither one was going to go to work despite the other. But finally, we both gave up at once. But this one was written at that house. I'd made up my mind I was going to make a living writing or die trying, and I came close. Mice in the house. One of them scampers down the curtain and up to my motionless feet. I have the feeling watching that representatives of two powerful races are meeting here calmly as equals. But the mouse will not be damn fool enough to go away and write a poem. Liu Yu, A.D. 1125-1209. This is taken from a footnote, a biographical footnote in the collection of Chinese poems, The White Pony. On the day of Liu Yu's last sickness, a thin coffin was ready, and two quilts to cover him, and the gravediggers paid, their work done. Then he started to write another poem a short time before death, about drinking wine again in the village. He was working on the poem when they buried him, so that half a line protruded from the earth, in wind and weather's hearing, with sunlight touching the first young syllables, the last ones flowering from a dark coffin. Marketplace, the inn, drink more one. The first three words above ground, the last ones wine in the red dust. Near the village of Shanyang in Shikang province. Snow at Roblin Lake. The exactitude of snow is such that even the Eskimo achieve mere mention of the stuff with his 20 names for snow. The wood pile slowly disappears. All colors blur to white. The shore miles fade to infinite distance in the white night. In 15 minutes more, the house itself is buried deep. In half an hour, the world is lost in a lazy, nebular, dead-end street. My little lake is not a lake, but endless ocean where I'll fish some cosmic tongue or trench and take Leviathan on a bent pin. This one is, along with several other of my poems, was more or less an experiment in which there are about three different rhythms. When you read it, you ought to be able to know this. They don't come until the end of the poem. The poem itself is called In Sickness. Fever and then chills. Body shaken and sweating through the night. Then yellow sunlight on the floor. So strange. Haven't had time to notice how light transforms old paint that way. Then tossing and turning, I get interested in the way my hand looks. Scar on fingers, slashed from glass when I was a child. And fever allows me to remember. And the far twitter of a sparrow 50 feet away in a cedar tree. A dog howling to be let in at some farmhouse. Fever and chills, oranges and lemons, say the bells of St. Clemens, and fever and chills. And myself muttering through the night, half asleep and tossing in darkness. The darkness inside myself, full of coiling tubes and pumps and valves. My brain imprisoned atop this some mindless factory, observing the faulty side effects of automation. I am tucked away in the blankets corner. I am secreted like a white candle in the red darkness. I see the myth of God as a kitchen chair full of wormholes and fall down and worship. I moan peevishly for water and some hag brings it, and overwhelmed with my own intrepidity I lean forward and drink and slobber and wonder, is that what affection is? A glass of water? And stagger to the bathroom scales, and my God, I lost 8 pounds. Morning and the birds sing and wind blows a little. Morning and it's summer. Hour after hour the sun shines hot and there's a patch of blue leaning in the window. Well, bring me a big kettle of elephant soup, honey. Also a dozen great ox yellow eggs, eh? Don't say one word. Just stand there with a broom for 5 minutes while the house gets dirtier and dirtier. Just stand there all morning long and let me look at you. One called Ballad of the Despairing Wife. I'm not at all sure that the CBC is how well. The time of her time was a dozen times on a single night, and she could be heard to say she would run away and live in a nunnery. So we made a pact for twice a week that sealed with menstrual blood, a solemn oath that the very most should be twice on Wednesdays once. The week was long ere Wednesday came, and Maynard visions rose of lesbian girls and hipster girls and chicks in horn-rim glasses and maids unclothed to turn to crones, dolls in dream pajamas. And Tuesday midnight Wednesday came, and prithy wife, I said, knocked on the wall where the door is small. Do you understand? And she did. For love is a broken oath by day, but sealed at night again. No armistice yet is the least effect on the wars of wife and man. She finally said, you'll wear it out, or me or both in the bed might well collapse, and then perhaps it's tungsten steel, I said. Took my rhythm outside the room, yam and then trochee, dithyrams that would not scan were decimals of infinity. Ere Wednesday came again, the stars had flickered their fuses down to guttering candle stubs aflame. They mourned an end for the human race, that signaled life from beyond the stars, back to a man at Roblin Lake. The cosmic rays cried down at me to people the earth and write poetry. The old fertility gods uprose and called me by my name. Go get yourself a mistress or two, or a dozen or more, she said. I swear by the penates and the lares, and earth is a ball that's round, but can't do half what you ask of yours. I'll be a virgin a month or more, and see you in hell, she said. Whereat I swear a husbandly oath, delivered with sound effects. The feathers shall drop from the mallard flocks, till I ask you again, I said. The week was long ere Wednesday came, and there I was at the wall. And she took me in, though love be a sin, and invented new names for God. O gal, my gal, with a beautiful mind, I love much more than you're behind, in which, however, Callippagus says, is none so good till a man be dead. Now in my mind I see the wall, and the door beyond that beckons to me. It may be large or it may be small, that don't give a damn for poetry. What it was. It was not exactly the unique... Oh, right away. It's good to do that right away, anyhow. What it was. It was not exactly the inequalities of schoolboy against bullying teacher, or later the fear, fitting into a strange conformity at a boarding school, or how cruelly alien boys were. For at the time I searched out chinks of reality in the high walls around me, and found perilous escape in books, night flights west, and sky causeways. Later still, I tore the loose membrane from a third ear, sharpening steadily now, I could never account for, and listening. It was never either exactly when things fell into place with a plop, audible in ordinary ears, so that at least I knew what others thought about the general purpose of condoms and women and ham and eggs, religion, and the institution of marriage, etc., and all the adjustments began of deciding whether I really agreed with them. Plus the dark intangibles like death and why. Even when bewilderment lifted a little, there was always the problem of how others acted, as against the way they said was the right way, as against the way I felt and thought was good, and making decisions by not making them, and the failure personally often, the shame, sometimes the shame, and again the listening. Of course, other problems exist here now, the necessity for patterns and pattern makers, deciding which are certainties and which variables, and very few of the former, and mostly latter, and always the occasional mistake, and sometimes the brain and heart's failure to know, say, this is the moment you'll always remember, this is the wind-blown instant of time that swings you into the future, oh, heavy as the heavy cellar stones of the world, but hammering on the gates of the sun. Or merely a little older, bewildered about things you didn't understand, that perhaps meant nothing, and fumbling to stay alive, and always to listening. Complaint lodged with LCBO by a citizen in Upper Rumbelo. Upper Rumbelo is mythical, of course, but 3 miles outside Hill. I am driving through town with a case of beer in the back seat, with two empties in it, which is illegal, see, and I notice this cop in the rear vision mirror following me on a motorcycle, and for a minute I feel peculiar. At the stop street I carefully stop, and the cop stops, not to be caught that easy. And I see him watching me sit, so I sit up straight as the motorist by Praxiteles, excavated by Henry Ford IV, from under a million traffic tickets of dead Greeks, speeding in Argus, Agora. Was it Hermes or Pallas Athena? Not the motorist at all. Anyway, there's that cop in my tail. I signal a left turn. He signals a left turn. I signal a right turn. He signals a right turn. And I think, what the hell is this, a game or something? And maybe didn't I brush my teeth this morning? And grin at him anyway in the rear view mirror. And figure out a hand signal for a ground loop, an inverted Immelmann. Plus an unorthodox Christiana I learned once in Parnassus, which lost me among the treetops. There, encountering God, hi, Pops, 50 feet above the business section. We stopped to talk, and I asked him about that damn cop of his, and ha-ha, how I fooled him. But he's parked waiting for me at the Presbyterian steeple. I got struck by lightning like a blue cop angel who's a dead ringer for the prophet Isaiah. And I says, you didn't make the turn signal. And he says, it ain't in the book. And I guess that's so, it ain't so. I get fined $15 and let off with a warning. But just the same. Some of these I don't like very much, you know. They have to go over the whole works. And, it's all right, we just skip the odd one. Besides, it'll take forever if we don't. A power. A power to say things, and they come out of the blank, gray desert mind onto paper, trudging the heat haze. Then they get away from you, though. Back to bed, lying beside a naked woman, both bitch and goddess, in the early drowsy midnight, at the dividing instant between sleep and wakefulness, between what we know and don't know, the arrow now, marking off the photograph past and a cartoon future. Oh, distantly in dim cloudlands, I suppose they come from, these sideways adventurers, slowly turning into my dimension, to chuckle in darkness, shoving me out of the strange woman's bed, to shiver under a lamp at midnight, taking their weird shorthand down. Extravagant creatures, swearing good true oaths like idiots, mouthing obscenities, whipping unbitten umbilical cords for lassos round your throat. Your throat? Oh, tragedian at midday, with black circles and packed suitcases under your eyes. That's me? All the inarticulate afternoon, waiting for evening. Then your wife, talking and talking of how the long day went by, and you, that's me? The bored husband nodding and lapsing into a comma's pause for supper, and television's awful semicolon, until all the lovely excommunicants come trooping back to tell me the way it was, he, my little liars, whispering stories about a country 29 days from now, and we were a long time coming here just then, so you'd better hurry along with us back there while you can and want to come and go with us, drunk man, drunk man. But why? Yes, why? A pride, I suppose. Optimist. In a black mood, there seems little reason to live. After a quarrel, at least a rejection of some kind. When ennui fogs the lens you look at the world with. Even sex dies down under proof of the virility of a habit. But it passes. One hemlock for the road. It passes. Shall we dance? The Vipers muse. It is portentous and a thing of state. A writes to B. A praiseth B's poem, saying, Canada hath need of thee in this hour. She is a fen, etc., etc. Straightway a second letter flieth fast to A, I, E. Thou art the sweetest singer of our old unmusical colonial breed, which proveth that the pen, at least, hath better manners than the sword, say. O A embarrasseth B with untruth. B does not dare reply unkind, which is to say, B, he lieth in his teeth. But whoso turns his eye this night to praise another poet, partly praise, exaggeration isn't such a bloody crime. As outright lying is and was, while Ananias' planet riseth silent gibbous yonder over Parnassus. That one's taken from a couple of other poets, some of the lines in it, Browning among others. Old Alec. This fellow died about 3-4 years ago. He made a deal with my father-in-law by which he gave my father-in-law a house in return for bed and board in perpetuity. And since Alec was an old drunk, and it was quite turbulent for a while, old Alec. 85 years old, that miserable alcoholic old bastard is never going to die, the man said where he got bed and board. But he did. I'll say this about Alec's immortality, though. If they dig him up in 1,000 years and push a spigot into his belly, why his fierce cackle drive a nail in silence. His laugh split cordwood, and trees kowtow like green butlers. The staggering world get drunk, and all the ghouls go scared. So you say, was I fond of him? No, not exactly, anyhow. Once he told his sons and daughters to bugger off, and then vomited on their memory. It'd be like liking toadstools, or a gun pointing at you. He sat home 3 weeks, drinking whiskey, singing harsh songs and quoting verse and chapter from the Bible, his mean and privileged piety dying slowly. They rolled him onto a stretcher like an old pig and prettied him with cosmetics, sucked his blood out with a machine, and dumped him into the ground like garbage. I don't mourn. Nobody does. Like mourning an ulcer. Why commemorate disease in a poem, then? I don't know, but his hate was lovely, given freely and without stint. His smallness had the quality of making everyone else feel noble, and thus fools. I search desperately for good qualities and end up crawling inside that decaying head and wattled throat to scream obscenities like papal blessings, knowing now and again I'm at least God. Well, who remembers a small purple and yellow bruise long? But when he was here, he was a sunset.